And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks, presented by Zaxby's DJ and Bucky back with you. And Buck, we've got a fun episode today, man.
Yeah, man. It's an exciting time. It's an exciting time because we're getting to the thick of the season. We always talk about this time of year. The first four games are still like the preseason. You're trying to sort out what you have and you're trying to get rotations and those things down. And now we're beginning to understand the identity of your team. And so we should see an uptick in terms of the level of play that we're getting. And with some of the moves that are being speculated, the bye week coming and some of the changes that are being made, it's a really exciting time, especially from our vantage point where we like to look at the team building process and how you can put together the ultimate team to win the title.
Yeah, one of the big pieces of news, the biggest piece of news this week has been the decision the Miami Dolphins made to make the quarterback switch to Tua Tagovailoa. Ryan Fitzpatrick goes to the bench. He had some interesting things to say about that. But if you're interested in learning more about Tua and the fact that he's left-handed is kind of unique, and we don't see many left-handed quarterbacks. We did our last episode with interviews with all types of guys that could speak on that subject, between Mark Brunell, Steve Mariucci, Michael Vick, on and on and on. I think we have five or six different guests on there. Chris Collinsworth, Boomer Esiason. So go back and check that out if you missed that episode. And on today's show, we're going to have some fun discussions here at the top, but we're also going to have an interview with Chris Fowler, somebody that, you know, we've both, everybody's followed and known about Chris Fowler forever. He's the best in the business, calling play-by-play for with Kirk Herbstreit on the number one college football game, calling the national championship every year. We see him on tennis coverage. We saw him as a host of Game Day forever. Go back to Scholastic Sports America.
That's what it was. What I was looking for. I was racking my brain. I was like, man, I've been in high school. Like, what was the show that he was hosting?
SSA.
He and Melissa Stark. They were hosting. They were hosting that. So now he is. Look, man, he is so talented. He touches so many different things, not only in football, but also what he does with the tennis world. He's one of the best. So it'll be a great conversation.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that. Before we get to him, though, at the top here, a couple things we wanted to hit on. We've got the Big Ten kicking off this weekend, which is going to be fun to see some of those top players, including Justin Fields, in action. But I do want to kind of put a bow on the whole thing that happened in Miami here real quick. Just your thoughts on, we've talked about the decision that was made, but now I'd love to get your thoughts on the way Fitz handled it in the press conference afterwards.
So here's the thing about Miami. I think Brian Flores did what everyone expected. We all expected that Tua Tagovailoa would be named the starting quarterback whenever they got to the bye week. That's the natural break in the season. That's typically when teams opt to do the red shirt thing where they start the rookie on the bench and then eventually they elevate him to starter. They normally do it around the bye week because it's an extended week. You get 2 weeks to get your quarterback ready to play. And so it's the natural marking point on the calendar to say, okay, this is where we're going to do it. Their bye week changed because of the scheduling reshuffling, so it moved up, and so it forced them to make the decision a little sooner. But I think Ryan Fitzpatrick's reaction, one, was shocking. Two, it was a bit selfish when I look at it, because it put the attention on him and took away from the team. And even though the news leaked out before Brian Flores had an opportunity to fully address the team, it just kind of created an unnecessary conversation around the team, because everyone knew that Tua Tagovailoa is the future. Even if Ryan Fitzpatrick plays well this year, like, okay, what is it? Next year, Tua is going to be the starter. So I really don't understand airing out the heartbreak. Yes, you've been demoted. Yes, it's hurting for any prideful player to find his way to the bench. But if you pride yourself in being a mentor and a leader, you had to know that was coming. And your job is to make sure that you do the stuff that is best for the team, not your own selfish interests.
In some ways, I almost wonder if they did Fitz a favor, that he's kind of going out on a high note here with the Dolphins, so that he's going to have an opportunity if he wants to go somewhere else and start next year. If you got another team that's going to be drafting a quarterback or needs a bridge, Fitz is coming off a high note and shows that he could be that guy. So if anything, I think the Dolphins kind of preserved him, saved him from himself a little bit, because you know the turnover games were going to come.
And it was coming. DJ, like, let's make no mistake about it. They shut out the New York Jets 24-0. But 7 of their 13 drives ended with a punt. Two others ended with interceptions by him. And so it wasn't like he's coming off a landmark performance. Yes, they defeated the San Francisco 49ers, and I think that was a big win because none of us expected them to go on the road and handle the 49ers in the way in which they did. But, I mean, he was playing fine. He had a couple three 300-yard games and those things. But in terms of being able to build this team for the long haul, you got to put the rookie in. You got to put the rookie in. You need to see what he has. You have to get him the experience, not only on game day, because I think a lot of people don't understand. In the National Football League, the way the practice reps work, the starter gets 80 to 85% of the reps. And so if two is the number two, he's getting 10 to 15% of the reps. He may only get 12 reps a day. That's not enough to accelerate his development to get him ready to play. And so put him in as the starter. Let him command all the reps in walkthroughs, practices, live game action. Let Chan Gailey get used to building an offense around his talent. And then let the front office see, how can we best help him? What kind of supporting players do we need around him? Do we need big guys that can expand the strike zone? Do we need quick guys that can take it down the field? Do we need these catch and run specialists so he can operate in the quick game? What kind of running back do we need behind him? A big banger like a Derrick Henry type, or do we need a scat back type? You need to see all these things so we can visualize and imagine what we need to put around him. And you can't do that by just looking at Tua play on the practice field.
Yeah, I'm going to mess up this phrase, but something along the lines of like, good is the enemy of great, right?
Yes.
I mean, because you can see good and say, we're comfortable here. This is good. This is not bad. We're okay. And it's like, no. We want to be great. And that's why we talked about the other day, we're talking about t-shirts versus titles. Do you want to be somebody who sneaks in the back door of the playoffs and gets smashed in the first round just so you can say, we had a good year. You know, we wild card team, that's a good year.
Yeah.
Or do you want to try and chase a championship? And the best way to do that is to get your quarterback up and running on his rookie deal, fill in around him, build it up as you were talking about there, Buck, and then we can go chase the big title. To me, I think it's just seeing the bigger picture. And the same thing, I don't feel bad, but I mean, this is the same thing that happened in college. Jalen Hurts was rolling right along. Think about it, and then they put in Tua over him and off they go. Jalen Hurts is a good player. Jalen Hurts won a lot of games, but Nick Saban knew that there was great out there. So he said, let's go that. Think about Clemson. Think about how they were rolling along. And it's like, okay, we're going okay, but we're winning games, we're undefeated. But man, this Trevor Lawrence, if we can get him up and running, when we have to face the better teams in the playoffs, he's going to be ready to roll. It was the right move.
Yeah, you got to do it. And it's funny that you brought that up because Nick Saban realized it in the middle of the national championship game. He poured a plug on Jalen Hurts, put Tua in, and he has another title because of it. You talked about the fearless nature of head coach Dabo Swinney making that move to pull Kelly Bryant to put Trevor Lawrence in. You recognize the talent and you understand at his best, Fitzpatrick is nowhere close to what Tua Tagovailoa is. And so if you're banking on the talent and the long-term potential, you have to go with the quarterback. And it's uncomfortable to make the move now because you're coming off win, you're sitting at 500 and those things. But let's be real, you're 500. It's not like you're sitting at 5-1 and 6-0. And so unless your standard is just mediocrity, you want great. Like, you're chasing great. Like, we're trying to win the Super Bowl, and that's what everything is about. It's not about winning the division. So, yes, we can be happy with getting the T-shirt and the hat and everyone celebrating us for winning the AFC East. But at the end of the day, it's about hoisting the Lombardi Trophy. And Tua Tagovailoa gives you a better opportunity to get to that point than Ryan Fitzpatrick, and that's why you make the move.
No doubt. I want to switch gears here real quick before we get to the college season kicking off, because I've been fascinated a little bit by the Rays. I've been reading a lot about the Tampa Bay Rays and how they've kind of built this thing. And everybody knows about their limitations financially. But there's a great article on ESPN.com about it. And I wanted to read this little quote to you here. And now, keep in mind, Andrew Freeman, who runs the Dodgers, you know, he started this whole thing with the Rays. And everybody underneath him is scattered all over the Major League Baseball. Working with Andrew Freeman, depth was always something that was critical to our organization. Eric Neander, the senior vice president of baseball operations and general manager of Tampa. For health and for unexpected performance in both directions, depth is a way to have guys who can surprise you in pleasant ways. In this division, we usually don't bully clubs with the top of our roster. It's really about flattening that talent slope from spots 5 through 40, making sure we're strong there. And I thought, man, that is a great picture, right? And the thing that's crazy about what the Dodgers have done now is the Dodgers have a deep roster. I mean, they have incredible depth. That's what Andrew Freeman took with him from Tampa. Now they have the resources where they can also have the stars, you know, those impact top tier guys, as well as a depth. And I thought from an NFL standpoint, when you look at teams, if you want to win a championship now, you not only we've talked about those 10 to 12 blue chip players you've got to mm-hmm. have, those key difference makers. But man, you better have depth in the defensive line, offensive line, and secondary, because you're going to have to be able to withstand some injuries as well as some poor performance to be able to rotate and roll guys through. And I thought, man, that's it's an interesting way to kind of to try and spread the resources that you have. Now, the difference is in NFL, you have a salary cap, so you got to be a little bit more concerned about that. But that's why it's so huge when you can get star performance, those mm-hmm. 10 or 12 blue chip players, star performance out of guys on their rookie contracts. So you're getting that star performance without the enormous cost, which allows you to really spread the rest of that out to get yourself a lot of depth.
You know, what I love about that and what I love about the Rays, it's funny that you brought that up, because I just had read something about the Rays and how sometimes you need to zig when everyone else is zagging. And what the Devil Rays have done is they've done that. They've taken an unconventional approach to be able to build a title contender. And it has enabled them to be able to do some crazy stuff. Oh my goodness. Hey DJ, so we just got a trade that came through, and I'm gonna talk about this. So the Minnesota Vikings just traded Yannick Ngakoue to the Baltimore Ravens for a 2021 third round pick and a 2022 conditional fifth round pick.
There we go. Well, this is what we had been talking about. We talked about this yesterday. We were saying this is going to be an active trade season. And when we went through the teams that should be sellers, Minnesota was one of the teams that we talked about in our conversation last night.
So, yeah, I didn't meant to interrupt your thing, but I think this goes with your point. So we talk about depth. So the Baltimore Ravens, we sit here and say that the Baltimore Ravens are championship caliber already, yep. as they were presently constructed before the trade. They had Calais Campbell on the line. They had Derek Wolfe. They had Matt Judon on the defense line. But yet and still, they still had the ability to know, for us to compete and compete for the long haul, we still need to add bullets to the gun. We still need more ammunition, because we're not chasing the teams that we're already there. We're chasing one of the two or three teams that legitimately have a shot to win it. And the team that we know is the front runner would be the Kansas City Chiefs. So how do you deal with the Kansas City Chiefs? You deal with them with a, what, four-man rush, so you can drop in coverage. You don't have to consistently blitz. The Baltimore Ravens have had a tough time dealing with the Kansas City Chiefs because they always have to bring pressure. And bringing pressure plays to Pat Mahomes' strength. Well, now, after looking at how the Chargers have had success against Pat Mahomes keeping the score down, after watching how the Buffalo Bills had a level of success keeping the score down, let's go get another pass rusher. So maybe we can change our style so we're not locked into always blitzing. Maybe we can play some four-man or some three-man rushes and drop seven or eight and see if we can slow the game down that way. And then on offense, it enables us to stick with the running game because the score is closer and it's not a shootout.
Yeah, and we've seen it with teams have done, which started with the Chargers. With Chargers with a four-man rush, just dropping in coverage and playing coverage. Then Mahomes ended up beating them with his legs. So then you've seen teams adjust, saw it a little bit with the Raiders. We saw it some with the Bills, where you put four down, but you only rush three, have one of those four spy mm-hmm. Mahomes to keep him from getting first downs with his legs, and you play coverage. Well, now, if you look at what the Ravens can do, you try and put your three rushers there. So you've got Calais Campbell and Ngakoue, who, by the way, were teammates and know each other very well. And I guarantee you that Calais Campbell provided information to the Ravens that vouched for him, that he would fit yes. with what they do. But now you could go, like, you could have a package where you got Judon, Calais Campbell, and Ngakoue really rush three. And if you want to just play, you want to keep Patrick Queen on the field, who's a legit, you know, big time speed, you can blitz him if you want, or you can just let him hang and mirror Mahomes and say, you're not going to run, you know, it's not going to happen. And you've got a chance if you can show with in disguises, which is what they do with Wink Martindale. Pre-snap look, disguise, and try and manipulate some one-on-one rushes, even though you might only be rushing three guys.
You got to love it, man. I love this, and I love the boldness of the move, because it is a bold move to go and do it. And something must have been going on, because that's a relative penance to pay for Yannick Ngakoue.
I don't think he's locked in, right? I think this is the last year of his deal.
He didn't get a new deal, but I guess I would have to go back and look at
what Calais Campbell for five. So you want to talk about a steal?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what did Ngakoue go to Minnesota for? What did they give up?
Oh, they initially sent a second round pick and a conditional fifth.
Oh, okay, that's what I'm saying.
Got it back. Yeah. So it was, okay. it was a second and a conditional five.
So yeah, so they lose. Yeah, so they lose the second, but they get the third. Yeah, look, it's an interesting scenario. It's an interesting move going forward.
Why we're here, Buck? Let's look at some of those other teams, because to me, when we were talking about this on the phone last night, we were talking about, okay, if you want to look at who should be sellers, and again, the reason why we're going to see a flurry of trades is because the anticipation is the salary cap's going to be flat, or the cap may even go down next year. So you've got a bunch of teams that are going to be way over the cap that need to get rid of some players and going to have to trim payroll. So if you're not going anywhere this year, why wait till the end of the year when you might be able to spin some of these guys off and get some draft picks in the process? So it's, to me, the sellers are bad teams with kind of expensive rosters or older rosters. So when I look at that, like the Jets don't really have many assets left to trade. The Bengals, I don't really see them really having much in terms of assets. Jags have a young team. The Chargers are in last place right now, but I think we'll see how they go. They're 1-4. They've already had a bye. I think what happens over the next couple of weeks could determine whether or not they might, try and sell off a couple guys. But now we start getting into Minnesota at 1-5, Atlanta at 1-5. Like, those teams to me are absolute sellers. Like, those are the two obvious sellers when you look at it. And to me, I would anticipate teams making calls on guys like Julio Jones with the Falcons.
Yeah, no, I think that is, I think it's the perfect time. And, we talk about trades, and the other thing that is hanging out there is the Antonio Brown situation. Yep. Because we've seen the Seattle Seahawks rumored to have an interest in that. And DJ, I think it kind of plays along with the Devil Rays thing in terms of, I mean, we can say Antonio Brown is a lot of things. He's maybe a locker room issue. He's had his issues away from the field. But if you can get him to game day, and we've seen him play, you're talking about a Hall of Fame caliber player. You're talking about a guy who has, 11,000 yards. He did it the second quickest time in 129 games, six straight 1,000-yard seasons. He's been a monster. And the prospect of being able to put him on the field with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, with Russell Wilson, who I think plays a style that works for Antonio Brown. We talk about Antonio Brown being a sandlot player, where that is where Russell Wilson is. It just gives them a ton of options. And if you and I are working in that front office and we're looking at our team and we know that we have a tough time stopping people, well, let's load up and see if we can make every game a shootout. And if we make every game a shootout and put so much pressure on you with our offense that you can't keep up, that is a way for us to play good defense, because we're dictating the terms with our offense. And I would say this, and I know there's a lot of love on the streets for DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. Neither one of those guys is Antonio Brown. Neither one of those guys, from a playing perspective, create the fear that Antonio Brown creates. And if anything, Antonio Brown's presence will make them even more lethal, because I think defensive coordinators will say, okay, who do we know that we have to double team? I think 84 would command the double team, and that would create more opportunities for those guys to really work out.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you can kind of rationalize and explain it, how it could work. I definitely think the theory here is that we're halfway through the season when he comes in. You're not going to marry Antonio Brown. You're going to date him for 8 weeks. I mean, that's kind of what you're going to do. But, man, it hasn't worked out. I mean, you talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers and New England Patriots. I mean, are they dumb? I mean, these are two of the best run organizations in the National Football League, who said it's not worth it. It's just not worth it.
I think with Pete's thing and knowing that front office, they always want to kick the tires on great players. And I think there is something that is leading them to take these chances at wide receiver, something that they see internally where they know they're not good enough. Because remember, they have Josh Gordon stashed away. And so, I mean, he's been fine, but he hasn't been like a dominant player when we've seen him play, in spite of his issues. There is some reason why Seattle is kind of kicking the tires on these wide receivers. It's something that they know they're lacking, and they're afraid that it'd be exposed in the playoffs or in one of those bigger moments against one of those top teams. And I think that's why they're willing to roll the dice on some of these troubled players.
Yeah. No, the talent is there. I don't know, man. Hasn't ended well the last three spots. And what's the definition of insanity, Buck?
Yeah, I know. Doing the same thing twice and multiple times.
Expecting a different result.
The only thing about that for Antonio Brown is now or never.
Yeah.
And it's a low risk deal, right? Like, we're talking about 8 weeks. He's coming in if he comes in, he comes in at a minimum salary. Like, there's no money tied to the situation. if he can't get it, if he messes it up in 8 weeks, like it's over. Like there's no one else that can do it. And if he can't do it in Seattle, who else is going to take a chance? Like there's nothing else out there. And so I think he knows. And I think with that, I mean, I don't think it'll ruin the chemistry and all that. And if your quarterback is advocating for it, it's one of those deals.
Yeah, just I've got one of the maybe the best young wide receiver in the National Football League on that football team, DK Metcalf, in terms of what he can skill set wise. And just be careful who you put in the room. That's all I'm saying.
And see, but I also be careful of like overvaluing your own player. Like he has been fantastic and terrific or whatever, but there's still some limitations to his game as a straight line guy. And I just wonder, like, can he be a traditional number one receiver when we get to that second go around? You know, he had a fantastic rookie year, but can he sustain it?
I got a trick question for you. Did you hear what he said to Stephon Gilmore when he was covering him in that game?
I didn't. What did he say?
Neither did Stephon Gilmore. He wasn't close enough to hear him, so he didn't hear it either. Yeah. So he's okay. I think he'll be fine.
I'm never mad at like a team trying to take a deal. I just think it's one of those things like risk reward. I think the reward is greater than the risk in terms of what he can bring. And if he can't get it right now, I don't think he'll ever get it right.
All right, we'll see what happens. All right, let's talk a little bit real quick here before we get to Chris Fowler. Your expectations, Big Ten kicking off. We've seen Trevor Lawrence have a fantastic start to the season. Now Justin Fields gets to get his crack at it.
Well, he does get his crack at it, but boy, you talk about the pressure on his shoulders, because I don't care what anyone says. He had to be peeking at those Clemson games, and he has to be reading and hearing the buzz surrounding Trevor Lawrence. And so the thing that he has to do is not try to do too much trying to catch up to Trevor Lawrence. He needs to be himself. I think he's a super talented player. Obviously, he had Ohio State in the playoffs, and I'm curious to see what he's added to his game. I think what we've seen from Trevor Lawrence, he has added, I would say, better management skills and ability. He doesn't appear to be in such a hurry to go big game, big play hunting, big play chasing. And because of that, I think he is a more dangerous player this year as a junior than he was as a sophomore. I want to see does Justin Fields add that part of it. So what can he add to his game to separate him from some of the other guys at the position? And I think this is interesting because Trey Lance is in the conversation as maybe the number two quarterback. So what does that look like? He gets more games than Trey Lance, but what does that comparison look like? Can he put some separation between him and Trey Lance if the conversation is who is the runner-up to Trevor Lawrence in this quarterback sweepstakes?
Do you remember, real quick, and we'll move on, do you remember when the season was not going to happen, it was Nebraska that was the most upset? Remember Scott Frost? We want to play. We're going to play. They announced it before everybody else. Like, hey, the Big Ten is back, before the Big Ten got a chance to even announce they were back. Have fun with Ohio State this weekend, guys.
Hey, man, the black shirts. We can bring the black shirts back. Maybe the black shirts going to come back. I saw their promotional video, and they're coming back. And maybe Tommy Frazier and those guys are going to run out the tunnel, and they're going to bring it back. They're going to line up in the eye and come back and go back to the mid-90s when they used to roll over people with two plays.
There you go. I'm not holding my breath on that one. All right. This is a fun episode. It's only going to get more fun here as we welcome in our next guest. He is a legend in the broadcasting community. You know him from calling games with Kirk Herbstreit on ESPN and ABC. Calls the game of the week. He's been doing it for a long time. Longtime host of College Game Day. You see him as the voice of tennis coverage for ESPN and ABC as well. And we can even go back a little bit further than that. But excited to join with our guest here, Chris Fowler. All right, excited to have Chris Fowler with me here. Chris, I guess we're got a lot of ground to cover here, but the first thing I want to hit you on, because I've been looking forward to this conversation, I want to go back to Scholastic Sports America, because I want to tell you my Scholastic Sports America story here. So I'm a kid. I'm probably seventh grade. I'm at go to Christian Junior High School down in San Diego, California. At Christian High School, we have Tony Clark. So Tony Clark ends up being the second pick in the baseball draft. It was a McDonald's All-American basketball player. So we find out early in the week on the campus, Scholastic Sports America is coming to do a feature on Tony. So, I mean, this is big news in El Cajon at this time. So we are all fired up. He's got a basketball game. The cameras are there shooting Tony during a basketball game. And then all of a sudden it's halftime and Tony doesn't come out. And I don't know what's going on. The cameras are gone. They're not there anymore. Scholastic Sports America needed footage of him throwing a baseball, and they didn't want to stick around till the end of the show. So at halftime, Tony put on his baseball uniform, went up to the baseball field so they could get B-roll of him throwing and hitting, and then had to get back in his hoops gear to get back for the third quarter.
That's a great television Mars, yet another athletic competition. That's my takeaway from your story. When I did the show, that was my first gig at ESPN, 86, 87, we would take places like El Cajon. We would, where do we want to go? And then you go through the binder. This is like pre-email, right? Mm-hmm. So parents would send in clippings and articles about their kid. Coaches would do that. We would just get these massive piles of stuff in the desk and like sift through it. Let's go to San Diego. There's got to be a kid in San Diego. Find me a story there. That's how it worked.
Oh, it's so fun. But that was our childhood, was watching that show. It was fantastic. One of the things you've got a chance to do this year, and we'll get into all the college stuff in a second, but calling an NFL game. What was that like for you, seeing these guys all grown up that you'd covered and called so many of their games in college?
Well, no, it was a surreal experience because I had come out of 14 days in the USTA bubble calling US Open matches. It wraps up. We had an amazing series of semis and finals. So I call a best of three thrilling women's final on Saturday, a five set crazy dramatic to an empty stadium men's final on Sunday, come home and then watch the Zoom calls with Ben and the Steelers that Sunday night. Preparation was a little bit mangled, I have to say. And then go over across the river to MetLife and call our first ever NFL game. And it was a blast. I mean, it was fun. We had plenty of time before the US Open. I looked at like six Steeler games and six Giants games from last year and really had time to kind of get ready for it. But still, stepping out of a tennis booth into a football booth to do a first time thing when, as you guys probably know, the broadcasts are really different. Like, you can't have your spotter next to you. The stats guy is over there in another space. Everything is a screen. So instead of having guys around you helping, it's just a bunch of sources. And you find yourself just like, it's like air traffic control, like scanning the screens. And oh, by the way, let's look at the field once in a while too. So the mechanics were weird, but it was so much fun. It wasn't Juju and Saquon and Dexter Lawrence. I mean, those guys I'm used to talking about. It was Ben Roethlisberger. That's freaking Big Ben. We were a little bit on the periphery when he was in the MAC. Like, we were joking about the MAC championship game was the last time he was as nervous as he was for that opener against the Giants. And so Kirk and I were joking about that. But just to call a Ben Roethlisberger touchdown pass, like, it's no big deal to an NFL broadcaster. But for me, stepping into that world, it was just kind of cool to see a legend perform that way. And it was obviously a meaningful event in his career. So to be there to document it was fun.
You guys did an outstanding job. It was such a good listen, as it always is.
Well, thank you.
The difference with college, calling college games, NFL games, I just know from doing the Charger games, I'm so excited when preseason is over because your board shrinks with all those names falling off. And I think
you mean this board? You mean my Michigan, Minnesota board here, a little show and tell?
Look, yes. You've got a lot of names
like written in here. Like, these are guys who are not really on the two deep. And you know how Harbaugh is with the two deep. Like, you don't really get a quality two deep because he wants to keep the opponents in the dark, especially in an opener. We finally had a phone call, our conference calls yesterday, and here's the board. But you're right. It's a very different experience calling NFL in college.
Yeah, trying to go through all those names. I can't imagine. While we're trying to do this comparison here, college NFL, I'd love to know a player, maybe on each side of this, a player that you saw in college that you swore would be a success at the NFL level that didn't necessarily happen. And then on the other side, somebody maybe you had some doubts about that then you see the success they've had at the NFL level.
That's a good question. I mean, it's easy to talk about, you know, the can't-miss guys. I think what's interesting, when you look at the things the scouts, you guys evaluate, I love what you guys do. I love the point of view that you approach a game with. When I watch games with analysts, a lot of times they'll watch tape with a personnel perspective in mind. That's not really how I watch tape, and I'm not qualified to analyze their qualifications for the next level. I know what I see. I'm looking at very different things when I watch tape in college. So to sit with Kirk, I've sat with, you know, Matt Millen or Trevor Maddich, and all these guys have sort of different things that they look at and analyze. But to get to your question, I mean, guys, I think that, you know, I was just really hopeful that Lamar Jackson would be a good pro quarterback. And there were so many skeptics and so many doubters. And I understand all that because their prototype has now shifted. And I get to know these guys in the awards season. We covered plenty of Louisville's games. I was there when he and Deshaun had this amazing duel in Death Valley. And Deshaun got the win, but Lamar was unbelievable. And they came up a play or two, a couple yards short of winning that game. And so, you know, I thought that he could translate. I think obviously we're seeing in a weird way offenses trickle up from Saturday to Sunday, as you guys know. And so he's a guy that everybody said was never going to be, not everybody, but only one or two teams that believe in him, right? But a lot of people were very skeptical. And I sort of get personally invested in guys like that and Baker and Kyler Murray. I mean, those three quarterbacks who've won Heismans and I've got to know very well, you sort of want them to succeed as someone that's invested in the Heisman community. You know, I want those guys to do well. And I'm really excited that they have. And so I take that's one of the ways, as I said, that I watch on Sundays. Guys that I love covering, how are they doing? You know, it breaks my heart to see Saquon go down because he's one of my favorite guys to watch in college. And I know how competitive he is, how much it means to him. So I guess I enjoy seeing guys who are great successes on Saturday, but doubted by people like you. No, by professionals whose job it is to be right on this thing. And I know how hard a job it is when your livelihood depends on it, and yet the batting average isn't great, right, for personnel in a lot of these teams. And guys who I think there's been plenty of guys that you sort of, for the same reasons, I'm an expert evaluator of talent for Sundays, but I like the player. I like their personality. The teammates say positive things about them, and yet then you just know it doesn't happen at the next level. So but that's the reality. That's the lens that we try to view Saturdays through. Mm-hmm. Is that these guys should celebrate being college players. Their dreams are not going to happen for a lot of them. They're just not going to make it, and it's a hard pill to swallow. But in the meantime, enjoy your college experience because that might be the pinnacle of what you ever do in the sport.
Absolutely. When you look at some of the young quarterbacks that we have that are playing at a really high level, are going to be kind of the face of the NFL as we go forward for the next decade plus. And I don't want to get into individuals, but has there been something when you're meeting with these coaches and meeting with these players? I'm just curious if there's been some characteristic or something you've been able to tie these quarterbacks together that have been successful. Is there, you know, toughness? We talked to Urban Meyer a lot about it. That word comes up and I don't know necessarily a buzzword, but have you been able to find anything you see, man, this sounds familiar with some of these other guys I've known that have been very successful that connects them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think toughness, not to piggyback because I'll get to other things, but toughness, it starts there, right? If you don't have the mental and physical toughness, the resilience to play that position at the highest level and be the face of a franchise, that all that entails, you got no shot, right? And not to mention take the beating. Just to give you a sense of, and maybe people who are not as familiar with the high end of college versus the NFL, I've watched NFL games from the field. I mean, not many, can't do it now, obviously, but I've had the opportunity to do it, and I've been blown away by the difference between that and even the highest level of college when it comes to playing the quarterback position, and really any offensive skill position, because of there's just the sheer violence, the speed, and the ferocity of the collisions. I've seen Bama, Clemson, LSU, Georgia, Ohio State. Okay, it's still not the same, and it's not close if you're being objective to it. I'm not talking down college. I'm just saying there's a different vibe that for an outsider to the NFL who steps into that world once in a while is palpable. There's like a, I don't know, can I, it's like a malevolence to it. Like, you are taking food off of my family's table and I'm going to stop you. Not that they're trying to hurt the guy, but you know what I mean? It's a very different vibe that I get.
Well, Chris, I'll tell you real quick, because I was going to get on this point. My brother, when I was working with the Baltimore Ravens, my brother came out to visit me and was going to take him to the game. I got the sideline passes. So the warmups end and he starts to walk. I go, no. I said, I want you to just stay down here for one series with the Ravens on defense. So you can watch and feel Ray Lewis and Ed Reed and the physicality, the speed and the violence. And so he's like, okay, well, you know, whatever. So we stayed there for the first series and his eyes got like this.
Yep.
Because whatever you think you see on television, you have no idea till you've stood on the sidelines and watched that up close.
No, you're right. And that's what I think. I wish more fans who criticize these guys, who call a guy soft, who like to label people or quick to criticize, you should see what you're talking about. You should see it up close and you might begin to gain some sense of understanding. Remember Rob Johnson, the former Bills quarterback?
Yeah.
Brett Johnson, Bob Johnson, his dad was
Mission Viejo.
Yeah. So I was out there. Yeah. I guess that's your part of the world. So we had done a Scholastic Sports story on Brett before he went to UCLA and eventually Michigan State. And I knew Rob when he was an eighth grader. So Rob's with the Bills now, and I get a chance to watch a Bills Dolphins game on the field. And that Dolphins at that point they had a nasty pass rush. And I was the same reaction that you're talking about your friend had. I was like, oh my God, I really like this kid. I've known this kid forever. I feel like his life's in jeopardy out there.
It's so true.
So, yeah, I think that it does start with toughness, mental and physical. You know, how can they command a meeting? Can they command your attention? Do they have that intangible quality? Because we all know what it's like to watch a talented guy throw the ball. In college, for me, it was watching Matthew Stafford's arm strength, Andrew Luck's accuracy. You know, Mariota had a precision to him, and he's at Oregon, but a lot of times he was throwing to open receivers. Luck was throwing to like this numeral or this numeral of like Zach Ertz. You know, it was that kind of accuracy, which again, when you see it live on the field, you understand how small the window is. You know, it just blew me away. And then you see, you know, some of the other intangibles that are evident. I'm speaking with like NFL style quarterbacks, not going back in the day, because there are plenty of option guys that impressed me too. But obviously, you know, I think Burrow belongs in that category. And in terms of what he brought to it, that offense that he orchestrated, he was a perfect storm, but it is the greatest, you know, college offense that I've seen in 34 years of being around the sport. And Joe, you could not fail to be impressed with him in a meeting. That confidence just came right through. I'm sure he obviously nailed the interviews. And you know, guys, they're just, you know, like Trevor Lawrence is going to go Deshaun. You knew they were going to kill the interview. They were just going to impress every single personnel person who was in front of them because they exuded those qualities. Obvious things like accuracy. I mean, we know that. It's the vibe you get off of them. And it's why you don't get a great feeling about every single guy you're around who's productive in college, because they maybe don't have those same qualities. And you just wonder, if you don't have it now and you're 21, 22, and you're at the top of this level of the sport, how are you going to get it at the next level where you're kind of starting over again? And a lot of them don't. So
that's fascinating. I would take the same approach here with coaches. So we're talking a lot about, we've already got two coaches openings right now in the NFL. We're going to probably have a handful. And there's inevitably going to be the discussion about college coaches, especially with the job that Matt Rhule is doing in Carolina. So when you've been around at the best of the best at the college level, is there anything that you pick up on in those meetings with, you know, the Nick Sabans, the Dabos, the Matt Rhules, whoever you've, you know, those coaching meetings where you go, okay, this guy's got it?
It's funny that you lump Matt in with those two guys.
I know the accomplishments aren't the same.
No, they were not different level of achievement.
But he has a presence about him. Yeah. When he walks in the room, as you were talking about with quarterbacks, I think you feel Matt Rhule when you visit with somebody like that.
Well, I think his players do, man. I know Matt was a Temple. We covered some Temple games, or a prominent Temple game, and I was around the program. I really like him a lot. We kept in touch after that first encounter, but watching the way that his players related to him, guys of very different backgrounds. And if you can go from there, right, Center City, Philadelphia, to Waco, Texas, to a very troubled and toxic situation out there, and try to pick up the pieces and relate to those players who don't have a lot in common from their background, the guys who are playing for Temple, and you succeed at that level, I mean, then you know, okay, he's got the gift. Not of dealing with people like me, but of dealing with players and getting the buy-in and getting the most out of them, and they want to play for him. I was really sad to see, you know, Matt Lee Baylor. I mean, Baylor was a really, really hard job after the Briles era.
Oh, yeah.
And Matt was, we thought he was crazy for taking the job. He had other opportunities. ended up working out great for him, but it was a blow sort of to that program and to college to lose him so quickly. I get why he wanted to go to Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously I became a Panthers fan the day they hired him for that reason. But he's got it. Dabo and Nick just have an organizational brilliance and genius, every detail. They're very, very different personalities, as you know, but they're both mm-hmm. at the highest level, and they create cultures kind of in their own image, and they hire coaches. Dabo's done it with the tremendous continuity of coaching assistants, and Nick has done it with a carousel of assistants constantly coming and going, which is incredibly challenging to maintain the excellence. I don't think people really understand. He's out for a couple of days preparing remotely for Georgia, their most challenging opponent. And because of that infrastructure, what he's put in place, like, that isn't even a factor. Like, it's no big deal at all. Mm-hmm. And if he hadn't been there, maybe it would have made a difference. But he came. That could have been super disruptive, right? To have him mm-hmm. out of the office in this game. And it's a testament to what he's put in place. There's no doubt that given a different situation than what he had in Miami, I mean, he would have been able to succeed. I'm just glad when these guys mm-hmm. decide to park themselves in college football for a while, because it makes the sport better.
I think just looking at those two individuals, when you look at Dabo and Nick, obviously totally different personalities, the team and a little bit of the image of them. But I think the word authentic, and I think maybe on the outside, some people think, oh, Dabo, that's shtick. And that's Dabo. That is,
he knows exactly what he wants. He knows exactly what he wants. Nick does too. That's what I get when you're talking about, and I don't know a lot of NFL coaches as well. I interact with them sometimes. We obviously did for the opener, very different personalities. You know, Tomlin and Judge are very different places in their career, but you can't help but think, wow, I mean, you're coaching a bunch of grown-ass men who are extremely wealthy. And now how are you able to connect with them? How are you able to be an authority figure, but also be a buddy when that's called for, and be a psychologist? I think in some ways it's even more challenging at the college level because the players are less mature. The rosters are double the size. But that aspect of coaching has always interested me. You know, do you know what you want in terms of recruiting, hiring, and can you get people to fit into that and then lead them? And it's, you're talking about guys who are at the top. The job is really difficult. You're trying to keep together a losing team. And that's where I feel for coaches at any level, because football is not very fun when you're losing, right? Mm-hmm. And they go in there and keep grinding every day. We don't do many games involving teams that are like 2-6. Yeah. But I look to the NFL broadcast teams, I'm thinking, wow, like, what would it be like to do a Jets game? I mean, are the meetings
a lot of nuggets?
Are they tense?
You got a lot of filler. You got a lot of filler material ready to roll.
From the jump, it's awkward because you want to talk about positive things, and when you have to grasp at some shred of positivity when the season's not going well, that's not something we have to deal with at the college level too much. We're usually dealing with teams that are doing really good.
You realize, so it's 11:54. It's 11:54 right now. At 1 o'clock, I'm leaving to go up to the studio in LA to call the Giants and the Eagles for Amazon. So this whole calling games between bad NFL teams thing is hitting a little too close to home for me right now.
Can you get in your contract to just avoid the NFC East?
But you know how it is. That'll have more. There'll be more interest in watching. Their fan bases are enormous in that division. They'll all be watching.
There's also a compelling nature and desperation. Right. Desperation. Sure.
That's what I'm selling. Okay.
Hunger and desperation. You can sell that.
That is fantastic. The tennis thing, I want to get into that. And I'll be honest with you, I know nothing about tennis, but I know when Serena Williams comes on my TV and I know it's a semifinal or a final, I find myself, I can't turn it off because of the competitive nature with which she plays tennis. And you guys do a great job on the broadcast and on the call. But she just pulls me in. Is there anybody else in the world of tennis that can pull you in like that? And what is it about her that makes her so dominant for so long?
Well, it's a lot of factors. I mean, what you're talking about initially is the it factor. She just has a great charisma in her game. Her game itself is charismatic. But the force of her personality, the fact that she lets you into her emotions, whatever they are, and brings you along for the ride, and that works for her. Players that conceal their emotions, try to stay calm and flatline because it works for them. I don't blame them. They're trying to win a match, but it's not compelling. It doesn't come through the screen in the way that you're describing. Rafa Nadal does that for me on the men's side. I think he's the most compelling, competitive athlete that I think that I've covered. And one thing about tennis that's fun, as opposed to my college football gig where guys come and go quickly, is you get to see these players and these personalities develop over time. So I've called Rafa matches, you know, for 15 years and seen him go from a teenager to a guy in his middle 30s who's still playing an incredibly high level. And he's probably the favorite athlete that I've called because his game is charismatic, effort and energy and passion, and he lets you in. He lets you see what he's feeling. And that's tough, man. When you only have two people to focus on the court and viewers only have two people to look at, and they're both flatline personality-wise, as great as the tennis is, it's kind of, you're limiting your audience, right? Because people who are not hardcore are not going to be interested in two people who are robots out there, even if you're playing great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about Federer? What's made Federer so good?
Well, I mean, he's like Mozart. He steps out there and he's got a skill set that is just pure genius. But he also knows how to take care of his body. No detail is left undone. His physical training, which you never see away from the tournaments, he doesn't show it once he gets on site. But what he does in terms of his flexibility, his movement, elasticity to maintain incredibly high level play, he's almost 40 years old, is so apparent. And then he's just got that regal presence. I mean, he just oozes like charisma in a different way than Serena does and Rafa does. But, you know, Federer is just, you know, he attracts adulation and it's just a magnetic way. I mean, he's the most popular player in the history of the sport. And Rafa is probably number two in terms of overall fan popularity. And you know, we're all preparing for the post Serena, Roger and Rafa era, and it's going to be a tumultuous time for the sport when those three big personalities step away.
Last question from me. You've been very generous with your time, and I appreciate it. Tell me about the podcast. Tell me about the new podcast you've got.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's not a sports pod, first of all, because ESPN kind of has me in that space, and I kind of want something that shifts away from the day job. So the podcasts are just topics that interest me, but there's a lot of sports guests on it. Well, Rich Eisen was on it telling NFL stories, and that's fun. People enjoy that. Willie Geist and Maria Taylor and Jeremy Schapp. That was in one episode, kind of the good, the bad, and the funny of their interview histories. Mm-hmm. So it's Schapp talking about Bob Knight, Mike Tyson, and Rich telling stories, and Maria about Nick Saban and other college coaches. And then Willie Geist is interviewed for his Sunday show on Today, Al Pacino and Letterman and Bill Murray. And so it was just an hour and a half of storytelling. Other episodes are on the bond of brothers. Got Patrick McEnroe talking about John McEnroe, and the Kings of Leon guys are friends of mine. So we talk about laughter. We're going to do episodes on travel and fitness, because fitness is a real big interest of mine. So Desmond Howard, who just turned 50 this year, is going to come on with Gabby Reese, who also turned 50, the ex-pro volleyball star. And they're going to share their wisdom on sort of what they've learned, what they wish they knew earlier. And so I find that it's more work. You know this, it's more work than you think it is going in.
Yeah.
My wife is
going to fun though. Don't you not like not having bumpers? I mean, for having a producer in your ear telling you, we've got this much time, you can go wherever the heck you want to go.
You know what it is though? I approach everything new with humility. Because you think you know what it's like to do interviews and you think that talking to people is second nature in a podcast format, as you know, and I'm finding out, it's different. You have the ability to let someone go on long. We can edit it if we want to. But unlike a TV interview where you feel like the meter is running, you can see, I'm long-winded as you can tell, but you can just see, imagine like a viewer's attention span is disappearing as this answer goes on longer. Well, we don't have to worry about that in the pod. I mean, we people love long-form conversations. They love being a fly on the wall, is my impression of it anyway. And so that part of it is good, but having to relearn how to do the interviews and just let it breathe and relax on the pacing of it and let them go and trust the material, right? So what you guys do is so focused and so precise and cool. Okay, I can't believe you have me talking tennis on here, because normally
I love it.
But you know, my thing is the opposite. It's like we're going to be doing heavy topics, talking about athletes in depression and regular folks in depression and how to overcome that. And then we're going to be talking about some very light topics too. So it's sort of all over the place, but we're kind of finding your way.
By the way, the name of it, right? Fowler, Who You Got is the name, yeah, is the name of the podcast. So I encourage everybody to go check that out and download it.
Yeah, the other story behind it, I'll tell you real quick. John Madden, you get a chance to hang out with John Madden when he was, I was at Colorado, and John Madden was doing a game at Denver and went up to Boulder to shoot a commercial. So I was, you know, I go down there and Mr. Madden, how are you? Just hanging around in the background. 10 people came up to him and said, John, who you got? Who you got? And I could tell that question pissed him off. It was like, you know, basically I'm going to bet in the game. Who do you like?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh God, take note of that. Never ask a question of anybody else when you, but I do get that question all the time. And now instead of answering, like I got Clemson this week or Alabama, yeah, I can say, you know, I got Desmond Howard or.
There you go.
So that's the conceit behind the name.
Well, I said it was the last one, but I want to see if you can help me out here. Give me some recommendations because I'm always finding different podcasts. Like I stumbled across this one. Have you seen this one called Fantastic Failures?
No,
it's genius. It's a genius. So they've taken these companies and these stories of these businesses that have climbed to tremendous success only to then completely fall apart. Like I listened to one on Toys R Us and it's always like the one fatal mistake that they've made. That cost them, everybody's talking about, let's study the greats and how do you become this, that, or the other. It's like, well, you can learn from the mistakes as well. And it's such a great concept for a podcast. So I've enjoyed that one, but are there any ones that you'd recommend that you've taken a liking to?
Yeah. Funny. I mean, obviously there's the obvious ones. There's like the Joe Rogans. And I do listen to that. I have a soft spot for aliens and UFOs and that kind of stuff. So I'll listen to the crazy stuff that he gets into. Probably not for 3 hours at a time,
yeah,
but I'm into a pod. I don't know if you'd like this or not, but it's one of these sort of unsolved mysteries. The premise is that the CIA hired songwriters to write the Scorpion song, Wind of Change. Remember that like anthem? It became a huge song in Eastern Europe. You know, about the time the Berlin Wall was falling and the time that the Soviet Union was just opening up. Mm-hmm. And so the band, by the way, denies this, but these two guys go in this investigation, talking to CIA agents, you know, anonymously. And I haven't finished the pod because I don't know if they come to a conclusion at the end of it. I don't want to invest in like 10 hours of my time only to say, well, who knows?
Yeah. No conclusion.
Maybe they didn't. But it's just fascinating to dive into this world and see the kinds of things that are covered in this format, you know? Mm-hmm.
It's all there for you. Well, I encourage everybody to check yours out. Fowler, Who You Got. Chris, this has been, it's been an honor. I've been a big fan of yours for a long time and Herbie's been great to us. So I appreciate you very much for giving us all this time today.
I enjoyed it every bit of it. We'll do it again anytime.
Well, that was a lot of fun talking with Chris Fowler from ESPN. Again, just as good as there is. And you can see just how good of a dude he is as well. So to get a chance to visit with him was a thrill. Get a chance to get some insight there on coaches and players, as well as a little crossover there in the tennis world. I feel like you always get a chance to learn something when you talk to somebody like Chris. So I do appreciate his time and hopefully visit with him soon down the road here. But that's going to do it for us today. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. It's been a fun podcast. We'll catch you next time right here on Move the Sticks, presented by Zaxby's.